Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everybody. 新年快乐. I've been speaking about the Mangala Sutta, that is a discourse in the Sutta Nipata. And the theme of the sutta is what is the true blessing in life. And as I've explained previously, this sutta presents us with what we might call a ground plan for the... Why does everybody sit way in the back? No need to huddle up in the back. Some people can come up into this. Okay, the Mangala Sutra presents us, we can call a ground plan for the ideal way of life. And it does so through a sequence of stages by which we progress from the earlier, more elementary, more fundamental stages to higher and deeper stages in the ideal way of life. It's not exclusively a spiritual or religious life, but it's an all-embracing conception of the ideal life, one which combines social, family, civic responsibilities with one's ethical duties, and then gradually evolving on towards the spiritual life. And just to recapitulate the territory that I've covered, the sutta begins when a deva, that is a deity, comes to the Buddha in the middle of the night and asks, what is truly auspicious? What is truly a blessing? And the Buddha begins with this sequence of stages. And he starts with what I call the proper orientation. And this concerns cultivating what I call the conditions for discretion. Discretion is the ability to distinguish between right and wrong, good and bad. And the conditions for discretion, those qualities that we have to set up at the very outset of our life, that have to be implanted in us even from an early age, is not to associate with foolish people, those who lead us astray, to associate with wise people, and to venerate those who are truly worthy of veneration. Okay, then once we have this proper association as the very starting point in the spiritual life or in the proper way of life, then we establish secure foundations by dwelling in a suitable locality, one which is both conducive to material well-being as well as to our spiritual well-being. We need a store of merits done in the past, and then we have to set ourselves on the right course here and now by making a resolution to cultivate proper conduct, meritorious deeds in the present. One prepares oneself, the next verse deals with preparations, training oneself for a successful and happy life. One needs a well-rounded education. One should learn a craft, a profession, a trade that will enable one to support oneself, and one needs a code of discipline that has been tested, tried, and has been found to be conducive to the moral well-being of you, the moral well-being of human beings. Then the next verse deals with fulfilling one's family responsibilities, supporting one's mother and father, maintaining a wife or husband, bringing up children properly, earning one's living by a harmless occupation. Okay, that is concerned with leading an ethical life in relation to one's family, in relation to society, by practicing right livelihood. Verse 6 is concerned with what I call becoming a pillar of society. Here, the ethical life broadens out by encompassing a wider range of people. One is now not concerned merely with one's own small circle of relations, but one now practices generosity by helping those in need, those who cannot support themselves. And also in this practice of dana or generosity, one supports, this is in the Indian society, in which there are the ascetics, the samanas, who have left the household life to go forth seeking spiritual truth. One supports these homeless ones who are devoting their life to the quest for enlightenment and liberation. Okay, so one practices generosity, then comes righteous conduct, dhammacharya, leading a good life governed by the 10 principles of wholesome karma. Then one helps one's relatives and friends, benefits them in different ways. And finally, one performs many diverse types of blameless actions. Any type of good, wholesome action not specifically mentioned in the previous types can be included under this category. Okay, that's a summary of what I've covered so far. Now, with verse 7, this marks what I would call a transition point in the unfolding of the Mangala Sutta. First, I will recite it in Pali, then give my explanation, then a translation, then an explanation of my understanding. Arati virati papa majapana cha sanyamo apamado cha dhammesu etang mangalamuttamam. Okay, the meaning, according to the translation we're using, ceasing and abstaining from evil, abstention from intoxicating drinks, and diligence in virtue. This is the most auspicious performance. Okay, when I say that this verse marks a transition point, the way I see it is that with this verse, there comes the recognition, or what is implicit in this verse, is the recognition that there is more to life than merely fulfilling our social, family, and civil responsibilities, more even than leading an ethical life according to the standards of the world. Rather, this verse indicates that we now recognize the need for liberation. And we are now moving on from, if I might use Master Yinshun's terminology, we're moving on from the ethics of the human and divine vehicles to the ethics of the world-transcending Dharma aimed at nirvana. It's not yet a stage of intensive practice, but we are now making that transition. So even though some of the ethical principles are very much the same as those that have been mentioned earlier, but the view underlying them is different. The perspective is different. The motivation is different. Now we are not just performing these wholesome deeds in order to conform to the expectations of society. We're not just performing them because this has been taught to us as the proper ethical code. We're not performing them merely to acquire merit and good karma leading to a good rebirth. But we are now undertaking these ethical trainings, this ethical discipline, as the very first step, the very foundational step, as the training that will lead us to ultimate liberation, to nirvana. And so with this verse, there comes the recognition, the acknowledgement that we have an inner life which is of supreme importance. And we also have the recognition that this existence is not the only life that we live, and it's not simply the case that this life will be followed by one other life after death, but we are now working in the framework of a perception that we are bound to this beginningless round of birth and death, and that we must seek a path to liberation. And we have now entered upon that path to liberation at the most elementary level. And so while the ethical practice in this stage is very similar to what was called dutiful conduct or righteous conduct in verse 6, the understanding and motivation is different. But this practice is not just starting out, building thin air, but it's building upon everything that came previously. And at this point, there is no distinction made here between monastic and laity, but we can call this the Dharma that is common to both laity and monastics. And we begin with two qualities I mentioned. Arati, Virati, Papa. The book translates ceasing from evil, abstaining from evil. I put these down as two separate blessings. Okay, and this is an important point now. Okay, the verse here is concerned with what I would call achieving moral integrity as a preparation of the mind for the training in meditation. Here we have this sila or morality as the foundation for samadhi meditation. Chia is the foundation for ding, concentration. And text, the way the Buddha usually does, begins with the negative side of morality. That is, we have to stop with the negative side of our conduct by ceasing from evil. And that is, why is this? There's a reason for this. Because in order for the positive side of our conduct, our actions, our thoughts to properly flourish, the negative side has to be held in check. It doesn't mean that positive qualities, that we can cultivate positive qualities only after we become perfect in restraining the negative qualities. But from a logical point of view, eliminating or curbing the negative side of our conduct takes precedence over cultivating the positive side. Okay, and we have these two aspects mentioned, ceasing from evil, abstaining from evil. Both have this relation to what is called papa, translated as evil. And that's a term not very popular nowadays. People think no such thing as evil. That's gone out the window with all of the other superstitions from the medieval period. But what do we mean by evil in Buddhism? It's not something dictated to us by any deity, by any god. Not even something that the Buddha dictates to us, this is evil. But what we mean by evil is any kind of conduct, any kind of action that is harmful, first of all, to our own long-term interests. Even though some action might be in some way profitable to us in the short run, it might bring us immediate gratification and enjoyment, but if that action is harmful to our long-term interests, to our true, deeper interests, we call that action evil. And if any action which is done intentionally for the purpose of inflicting harm and suffering on others, that too we can call evil. And according to the Buddha, evil exists in at many levels. The most manifest level is in unwholesome actions, unwholesome speech. But we have to deal with the evil at the level of thoughts, the defilements that come into the mind, and even more deeply than the defilements of the mind, what we call the underlying tendencies of the mind, the deep, very deep roots from which the evil thoughts, the unwholesome thoughts, the unwholesome actions arise and emanate or issue forth. And so, first stage is called arati, which means, I don't like ceasing from evil, I would call it non-delight in evil. That's more literal. It's the opposite of rati. Rati is delighting, enjoying what is bad and harmful to oneself and to others. And arati is stopping this delight in evil, developing a strong repugnance or a revulsion towards unwholesome conduct, unwholesome thoughts, defiled emotions. And that is fulfilled, or at least it's implemented, by virati, refraining from evil, abstaining from evil. This is where one makes a deliberate determination to abstain from unwholesome deeds. we speak in the Buddha's commentaries, the Buddha's commentaries speak about three types or three levels of refraining from evil. One is spontaneous refraining from evil. This is where somebody has not formally taken precepts, but they might find themselves in a situation where, let's take an example, a student on an exam has the opportunity to cheat and to get a better grade on the exam. Maybe the student ahead of him, a very brilliant student, leaves his paper exposed, and you can just peek and see that other student's answers, and then you could fill them out and you get a better grade. But just spontaneously, some innate tendency comes up and one doesn't want to fulfill that. One just automatically stops oneself. Or if one is at work and you see that there is an opportunity to take things from the office and nobody will know about it. But just spontaneously, of one's own individual volition, one stops oneself. That is one type of refraining. But the second type makes refraining stronger, and that is refraining through the formal undertaking of precepts. This is, you undertake the ritual, the ceremony of taking a particular set of precepts, as lay Buddhists, the five precepts: abstaining from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, false speech, use of intoxicants. And then by taking these precepts and bearing them in mind, this gives a stronger defense against the tendency to act irresponsibly, to give expression to these unwholesome tendencies. Then the third type of refraining is called refraining through eradication. This is when one reaches a certain level of enlightenment, then one becomes incapable of breaking, of committing any kind of moral transgression, of acting with unwholesome motivation. That level might be far away from us, so the level that we have to work on is the level of refraining through undertaking the code of the precepts. But it's pointless if one takes the precepts, even if one recites them daily but doesn't act on them. Then one is really defiling the precepts. So when one undertakes the precepts, one has to observe them carefully and properly. Okay, then the next one comes, Majja Pana Ca Sanyamo. That is, abstaining from, literally it's abstaining from intoxicating drinks. More broadly, one could say abstaining from any kind of intoxicating substances. This is included in the five precepts. Taking intoxicants itself, I would say, is not an evil deed in its own right. But a person who takes intoxicants regularly and who takes them especially to excess loses the grip on the mind of hiri and otapa, of that sense of restraint and the fear of consequences. So when a person, even if they're taking drinking casually and usually not taking to excess, but still there is this tendency to enjoy oneself through drinking. So if that person gets into some deep personal trouble and wants to blot out the world, the way they'll do so is by taking more drinks. And once the person starts taking drinks, a lot of drinks, the drinking will erode that person's sense of conscience, and the person becomes more prone towards moral transgression. So that is why the Buddha has included this factor within the five precepts. Then comes diligence in wholesome practices. Diligence here, the word for diligence is appamado in Pali, in Chinese, bufangyi. And this is a quality on which the Buddha laid very, very great importance, even throughout his whole teaching career. Even the very last words of the Buddha were appamadena sampadeta. Strive on, or literally, achieve the goal through diligence. And diligence means heedfulness. And it's opposed to another quality of the mind that we call negligence or heedlessness. Negligence means that we allow the mind to roam about at random without any control, any restraint. And when the mind roams about at random, then it becomes like a boat without a rudder, or like a wild pony which can just run anywhere, untrained, unbroken in. And when the mind is allowed to run around at random, then it will naturally fall under the sway of greed and sensuality. That is the innate tendency of the mind. And if the mind is allowed to drift further and further away from this controlling hand of diligence or vigilance, then we start to lose the sense of this, what I call the sense of discretion, the sense of the basic distinctions between right and wrong, between good and evil. And so diligence means not allowing the mind to wander, not allowing moods or feelings to dominate the mind, not allowing the mind to come under the sway of deluded thoughts. Diligence involves a keen perception of the pitfalls, the disadvantages in self-indulgence. Okay, what are some of the things that cause heedlessness or negligence? One of them, particularly, is youth for young people. When one is young, one doesn't realize one is going to grow old. And so one becomes intoxicated with one's youth, enjoys one's youth, and loses sight of the fact that one is to grow old. When one is in radiant good health, then one loses sight, can become heedless or intoxicated with that good health, and lose sight of the fact that one is subject to sickness. If one is beautiful or handsome, one can become intoxicated with one's beauty or physical beauty, and lose sight of the fact that this physical beauty is transient and only skin deep. If one is strong, one becomes intoxicated with one's strength, with one's intelligence, whatever. And so all of these assets that one possesses might become grounds for clinging, for delusion, for conceit to arise. And if one is fortunate, then one loses sight of the misfortunes of others. And one becomes intoxicated, attached to one's own good fortune, and one loses concern for the suffering and misfortunes of others. And so diligence in wholesome practices means that one maintains one's wholesome practices consistently. If one is observing precepts, one observes the precepts consistently. When one is practicing meditation, one should be consistent in one's meditation practice. If one is practicing charity, generosity, one should devote oneself to those charitable practices regularly. Whatever wholesome practices one undertakes, one should maintain them either at a consistent level or one should develop them further. But one should not allow oneself to become slack and to deteriorate, to decline. Okay, this is the explanation of verse 7. Now I come to verse 8. This deals with what I would call the positive side of the spirit of the ethical life, developing positive ethical qualities. I'll recite the verse in Pali, then translate, then give explanation. Garavo cha nivato cha santuti cha katanyuta kalena dhamma savanang etang mangalam uttamang. Okay, taking the translation from the book, reverence, humility, contentment, gratitude, and timely hearing of the Dhamma, this is the most auspicious performance. Okay, so now the previous verse deals what we might call the things that one abstains from, refrains from. So diligence is a positive quality. But now we start mentioning positive virtues, virtues that we have to cultivate. And the first of these, and this is extremely significant, is respect or reverence. And this is mentioned first, I think, because in entering upon the world-transcending Dhamma, the way to liberation, the quality that leads one, that makes one capable of absorbing, of receiving and absorbing spiritual teachings, is respect and reverence. Even the Buddha, after his enlightenment, while he was still sitting under the Bodhi tree, he wondered to himself, he thought, it's important to live having respect and reverence. And one has to have respect and reverence for those who have superior qualities. But then he thought, using his Buddha vision, he thought to himself, is there anybody who has superior moral virtue to myself, superior concentration, superior wisdom, superior liberation? And he realized nobody surpassed him with respect to those qualities. But he thought, I still want to live having respect and reverence, so what should I respect and revere? Then he thought, I achieved my enlightenment in dependence on the Dhamma, and so I will live having respect and reverence for this Dhamma that I followed to achieve enlightenment. Okay, so taking the Buddha as a model, we have to have respect and reverence. And this respect and reverence means that we are ready to recognize, to appreciate the good, noble, spiritual and ethical qualities of others. It means that we are able and willing to put ourselves on a lower position than those who have superior spiritual qualities than ourselves. In order to advance in the spiritual life, we have to have faith in the possibility that there is some higher goal to achieve, that it's possible to attain that goal, and that there are some people either who have realized it or who have made better progress than ourselves in advancing towards that goal, and who can give us help in walking the path to that goal. And so, in the spiritual life, we show respect and reverence to those who serve as our models, teachers, and examples. In the secular life, the social life, we also have to have respect. We have respect for parents who bring us up, respect for the elders in our family, respect for our teachers. In the religious life, we have respect and reverence above all for the Buddha as the supreme teacher. At the personal level, we have respect for the Sangha, that's the monastic community that has preserved the teaching. We have respect for those within the monastic community who might be our personal teachers and spiritual friends. And then it's not sufficient merely to have respect in the mind, but it's also important to know the proper ways of showing respect. That is, within any spiritual or religious tradition, respect and reverence manifests itself in certain fixed forms. And these forms are what translate the mental attitude of respect into proper bodily behavior, proper ways of speaking. And so there's this relation between our mental attitudes and our forms of behavior. The attitudes are expressed in behavior, and behaving in the correct ways helps us to cultivate the proper attitudes. So within the Buddhist tradition, some of the correct or proper ways of showing respect we call one vandana. That means prostration, bowing down, for example, to the Buddha, or bowing down to senior monastics. Then we have the gesture called anjali, joining the hands and making a kind of half bow. Another form of showing respect is standing up when senior teachers enter a room, offering them a seat, say if they come to visit in the house, offering a seat, offering refreshments, speaking politely in the proper ways. These are all ways in which one shows reverence in one's behavior. And showing respect is beneficial. It's not that it benefits the one who receives the respect, but it's a way of benefiting ourselves and others. First of all, by showing respect, by having a respectful attitude and showing respect, one helps to maintain a noble tradition, an important tradition. Like all of these forms of showing respect that I've mentioned, these have been passed down through the Buddhist tradition for 2,500 years. We might think now we're in America, this is a democracy, everybody is equal, we could all do what we want. But my belief is if we discard these forms of showing respect that have come down in the Buddhist tradition, everybody is jolly good fellow, we all do what we're all equal, everybody treats everybody the same, then before long, the Buddha sutras on the same level as the popular novels, and Buddha's practice on the same level as gymnastics and entertainment. Okay, so we maintain this noble tradition. We promote group harmony, because the harmony of the group is promoted when people, everybody shows each other proper respect. One sets a good example for others. And most important, showing respect and having reverence in the mind will lead one to good teachers, just that is the natural way through the working of the law of cause and effect. It will lead one to good teachers and enable one to learn the Dhamma. The seeds of the Dhamma will sink down deeply in the mind of one who shows respect, and those seeds will germinate and grow in the respectful mind. But in the mind of one who is casual, disrespectful, listening to the Dhamma will just come in one ear and out the other. It won't be able to germinate and bring benefits. Okay, so respect. The next quality is, you could say, the natural accompaniment of respect or reverence. That is humility, being humble, being soft and gentle, not being stiff and arrogant, proud and haughty. When a person is soft and gentle, then they can easily be trained easily. They get along easily with others. And extremely important, such a person readily accepts advice from others, accepts correction from others. This is like clay. Clay is very soft, so you can mold clay in different shapes and make many useful objects out of it. But if you take hard stones from the road, you can't mold them or do anything useful with them. Or again, as an example of humility, we can take water. Water always flows downward, seeking the lowest places, but water will wear away the hardest rocks. One good example of humility was the Buddha's disciple, Venerable Sariputta. This was the Buddha's right-hand disciple, who was the foremost disciple in wisdom. He always, when the Buddha was giving discourses, he always sat by the Buddha's right hand. The Buddha always praised him very highly. One time, Venerable Sariputta was putting on his robe, and then he was walking along, and some 7-year-old novice noticed that Sariputta's robe was dragging along the ground. And so he came to Sariputta and said, "Venerable Sir, excuse me, but I wanted to tell you that your robe is trailing along the ground." Venerable Sariputta looked and noticed this. Then he readjusted the robe, lifted it up, readjusted it, and then said, "Thank you, sir." And then he said, "Today I am glad to receive the advice of a 7-year-old novice." And so when the Buddha heard about this, he said, "Sariputta, who is from the Brahmin clan," so he was not only the foremost disciple, but a Brahmin, he said, "Sariputta has the humility of an outcast boy wandering at the outskirts of a village. He's like a bull with horns that have been cut off, completely harmless." Okay, so humility, then comes gratitude. Gratitude, the Pali word katanyuta means literally knowing what has been done for one, knowing favors that have been done for one. The Buddha's commentators speak about, we have one word, gratitude, but the Buddha's commentators speak about three levels of gratitude. One is simply appreciating the favors received from others, remembering them and thinking about them with gratitude. The second is appreciating the favors and then making an effort to repay the debt of gratitude one owes to others. And then the third is one appreciates the favors, one makes an effort to repay the debt of gratitude one owes to others, and in one's mind, one honors the goodness of the person who has done the favor to one, and one constantly continues to feel thankful to that person with respect and appreciation. I want to mention the example of one of my own teachers, the elderly German monk, Venerable Nyanaponika Thera. In his old age, he told me he used to do this meditation daily, where he would think back all the ways to his youth, and he would remember with gratitude the benefits that every significant person in his life had done to him, done for him, from the time his parents, his people who had significant influence on his early life, his turn to Buddhism as a 17-year-old boy in Germany at the beginning of the 20th century, through his early 20s, then his teacher, who was also a German monk, then all the ways right up to his old age, and he would do this every day. Okay, and when we cultivate this quality of gratitude, we think not only of those who have directly done favors to us, but we could expand the sense of gratitude by what I call widening the circle of gratitude, by thinking of all those who are in some way indirectly helping us, indirectly or through various levels helping us. For example, we think of the people in this monastery who do the shopping for us, who prepare the food for us, the man who brings the bottled water for us every couple of weeks, the people who help with the repairs in the monastery, everybody who helps in any way with the office work. Then we could think of the people who help to repair the automobiles, people who help run the city. Well, I have to be a little careful here. At some point one has to withhold that sense of gratitude and maybe develop a sense of compassion. Okay, and then the last quality mentioned in this verse is listening to the Dhamma at the right time. Almost any time is the right time for listening to the Dhamma, but what is meant here is that from time to time one should really make an effort to listen to the Dhamma. Don't just do it once a month, a few times a year, but especially the people who have easy access to this monastery should try to come at least once a week to listen to the Dhamma. And when one listens, one should listen with full attention, listen with a concentrated mind. And one should try to retain what one learns. Don't just listen casually, like you're listening to the radio, to a talk show on the radio, or a talk show on television. But listen with concentrated mind, trying to retain what one learns. And in the old days, the Buddha's time, writing wasn't used, so people had very good memory. But nowadays, our memory not so good. So, some of us cheat, we have recorders. But if you don't cheat with a recorder, better way is to take notes. Because if you take notes, you have to make the effort of writing down. That helps you to focus your mind on what you're writing, and that will give imprints on the mind. But don't just take the notes and put the notebook away. But when you take the notes, review the notes periodically, and when you come to important points, especially in really analytical discussions, try to review those notes and absorb them so that you get the Dhamma deeply imprinted upon the mind. This will bring numerous benefits. For one thing, it will inspire confidence, greater confidence in the Dhamma. Because you listen to it, now you're really learning it well. You come to see the very beautifully integrated structure of the Dhamma. This helps you to overcome doubt and to get rid of wrong views. It will increase your knowledge and wisdom, and it shows you the way to overcome mental defilements. And these seeds of learning the Dhamma, when you really do it methodically, the Buddha himself says this, from life to life they won't go away. But when you study the Dhamma well, those impressions will stay with you. And in the next life, when you encounter the Buddha's teaching, if you've learned it well, those impressions will start to blossom very quickly until you start to absorb more Dhamma. And when you start listening, immediately the structures of the teaching start manifesting in your mind, and you come to understand well, to learn well and quickly. And by learning the Dhamma, listening to the Dhamma, learning it well, this will become like your map, your guidebook on the path to enlightenment. Okay, I thank you all for your attention, and I wish you all the blessings of the Triple Gem today and throughout the coming year. Now we'll recite some of the verses to share the merits of our listening to the Dhamma, teaching the Dhamma, to share the merits with the devas, the deities, the Buddhas, the other beings, wishing them to be peaceful, well, and happy. Akasatacha Bhumata Devanaga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasatacha Bhumata Devanaga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasatacha Bhumata Devanaga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Manparam Etavata Chamhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabbe deva anumodantu. Sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi. Sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe bhutanumodantu. Sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cham hehi. Sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe satanumodantu. Sabba sampati siddhya. Pavagupadaya. Pavici hetato. Etantare satakai upapanna. Rupya rupi cha asanya sandino. Dukkha pamucantu. Pusantu.